Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Frederick Clarkson, who examines the conservative Christian religious beliefs of Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. Bill Dienst, a physician from Washington State who talks about his recent solidarity boat trip that challenged Israel's blockade of Gaza and his brief detention there by Israeli and Egyptian officials. And Celia Wetzler, of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who calls on Congress to strengthen the federal whistleblower protection law. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
India's political opposition was up in arms over a letter sent by U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice placing conditions on the India-United States nuclear agreement that will sharply limit India's ability to test nuclear weapons. In a letter to the Indian government, Rice declared the agreement, which aimed to promote civilian nuclear power, would be revoked if India tested more nuclear weapons. India's refusal to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has resulted in a global ban, preventing the country from importing nuclear material shipments. The US and India are now seeking to waive the ban, which was recently approved by the nuclear supplier group despite objections from a number of European countries. According to the Washington Post, the Rice letter contradicts statements made by Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh in August 2007 when he told Parliament the nuclear agreement did not curb India's right to undertake future nuclear tests. India's Communist Party withdrew from the governing coalition in July to protest the US nuclear agreement. The opposition Hindu nationalist BJP party has also been highly critical of the deal. Before the waiver was approved by the NSG, a group of nations led by Austria, New Zealand and the Netherlands proposed a series of amendments to the nuclear agreement. They wanted more explicit rules regarding Indian compliance with non-proliferation standards and a regime for enforcement. But heavy lobbying by the Bush administration trumped concerns over nuclear proliferation. As Russia's relations with the United States and Europe chill over Moscow's invasion of Georgia, Russia is in talks to boost military and intelligence cooperation with its former Cold War ally, Cuba. In late July, Prime Minister Vladimir Putin sent a high-level delegation to meet with Cuban President Raul Castro. While the delegation dealt mostly with economic issues, it did raise the prospect of a greater Russian military presence in Cuba. According to the Los Angeles Times, top American officials are worried about increased Russian-Cuban intelligence operations, including the revival of a massive surveillance complex that once housed over 1,500 Russian engineers, technicians, and military officers before the Russians pulled out in 2001. During his confirmation hearing, the new Air Force Chief of Staff, General Norton Schwartz, insisted that Russian ships refueling in Cuba would cross a, quote, red line in the sand. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez recently invited Russia to hold joint naval maneuvers off its coast. Moscow, alarmed by the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe and a planned U.S. anti-missile base in Poland linked with the Czech Republic, is attempting to counter what it perceives to be Washington's aggressive behavior. Russian military analyst Alexander Goltz noted, Russia only spends 3% of its economy on the military and could not afford an aggressive military posture in Cuba or elsewhere in the American hemisphere. 3 years ago, Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal filed a lawsuit against the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind education law. Blumenthal sought more federal funds for school districts to conduct student tests mandated by the law. Quickly, the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers' union, endorsed the lawsuit. But big potholes lay ahead for the suit against No Child Left Behind. According to the American Prospect magazine, in early 2006, the Connecticut chapter of the NAACP filed a lawsuit against Blumenthal on behalf of minority school children and defended the education law. The NAACP noted Connecticut, a wealthy state, had the nation's largest achievement gap between poor and non-poor children. The NAACP also charged that Blumenthal, a prominent Democrat, filed the suit as an excuse not to meet the needs of Connecticut's children of color. In Congress, Democrats have embraced a bill to gut the accountability standards in the No Child Left Behind Act, with the support of right-wing Republicans opposed to mandated testing. The bill has been blasted by Latino groups such as the Council of La Raza, saying it may reverse recent progress in minority student performance. The American Prospect magazine urges progressives to look at successful state reform efforts such as in Massachusetts that link increased funding for poor districts with rigorous academic standards. The program in Massachusetts demonstrates that real reform can work to improve the performance of lower-income public school students. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
During the course of the Democratic primary campaign, Barack Obama was subjected to intense media scrutiny over his relationship with his longtime pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright, and his controversial remarks captured on video. Now, with John McCain's selection of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin as his vice presidential running mate, questions are being asked about the role her conservative Christian religious beliefs would play in public policy if the Republicans win the November election and, through unforeseen circumstances, succeeded McCain as president. Palin opposes abortion even in cases of rape or incest and is against stem cell research. She doesn't believe in evolution and advocates the teaching of creationism in public schools. The Assemblies of God Church, where Palin worshipped most of her adult life, believes that the end times are near, foreshadowing the end of the world and the second coming of Jesus Christ. When Palin was mayor of Wasilla, she reportedly asked the local librarian how she could go about banning books with inappropriate language. During a June 2008 speech at her former church, Wasilla Assemblies of God, Governor Palin told ministry students that the United States sent troops to fight in the Iraq War on a task that is from God. Also controversial is Sarah Palin's association with the Alaskan Independence Party, state affiliate of the right-wing theocratic Constitution Party. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Frederick Clarkson, who has written about religion and politics for more than two decades. Clarkson examines Palin's conservative Christian beliefs and the effect they could have on public policy if she and McCain win the White House.
She's been preparing herself to be a national politician, or at least a statewide politician, for some time. But she's rooted in her religious communities, in her Pentecostal, evangelical Christian communities, of which she's been involved in a number of different churches over the years, but the main one was the Wasilla Assemblies of God. And this church and other churches that she's affiliated with believe that we're living in a biblically prophesied end times, and that hold to a worldview that begins with creation and ends with the end times. So there's a whole worldview that she speaks to. She specifically said that she believes in creationism, and she has indicated to friends throughout her life that she believes that she may see the second coming of Jesus in her lifetime. It's a distinct worldview, and one certainly with a lot of political and public policy implications as well. She gave a speech at a graduation ceremony for ministry candidates at her old church in Wasilla, where she asked them to pray that the Iraq War was a part of God's plan, suggesting that indeed it was. And she also suggested that her proposed $30 billion pipeline plan was God's will. Now, this is a place where whatever people's religious beliefs are, they're entitled to them, and we need to respect that. But we also can reasonably ask them, okay, how then do you see your particular religious beliefs affecting your public policy views? It's a remarkable thing to connect one's religious views with a gas pipeline, for example. But even more seriously, if the Iraq War is a part of God's plan, or any war is a part of God's plan, it's reasonable to ask her why she thinks that might be so, and what else might be a part of God's plan as well. I don't think in any time in American history have we had a candidate for national office whose views of biblical prophecy in the book of Revelation might be so central to their foreign policy doctrines.
Now, what do we know about Sarah Palin's personal belief and the church to which she belongs related to dominionism, a belief that a theocracy should be established to replace our current democratic form of government here in the United States? Do we know where she stands on dominionism?
Not precisely, but I think we get clues in the very list of issues that you laid out before. All of these things are outgrowths of her particular worldview, and they're dominionist insofar as they're theocratic. And that is, if you're going to impose, for example, her view of abortion, which is what's called the 100% position, when that is no exceptions for rape or incest. That, as a matter of public policy, is a highly theocratic view, not because it's pro-life, but because many other religious traditions have a different view of when life begins. So to take one particular religious view and say this is what ought to be the law of the land is a theocratic idea. And the same thing goes with the teaching of creationism in the public schools, which she thinks is a reasonable alternative to the teaching of evolution, or at least presenting it as an alternative theory. This is, you know, failing to distinguish between religion and science, hence also a theocratic view. If creationism is the truth, even to present it on the same plane as science, when it's in fact it's a religious view, is then a theocratic idea. We see this across the board with her. So dominionism, I don't know if we're ever using the word, but her ideas are dominionist, absolutely.
Fred, how important a player are the religious right groups within the Republican Party today, and why should people in this country be concerned about that?
They remain perhaps the single most powerful bloc within the Republican Party. The religious right is largely anti-democratic in their views. They give lip service to constitutional democracy, but they're really about religious supremacism and theocratic ideas, as we were talking about earlier. They represent a danger to people who share democratic values in that respect. But quite aside from their views, they have a permanence in American public life. Over the past couple of decades, they've developed a tremendous political capacity, large organizations. Some of them have come and gone, yes, but they trained generations of activists and leaders who've now found their way up into American public life in powerful ways. They have developed universities and even law schools. They're graduating lawyers who are becoming state legislators, and so on. Sarah Palin is interesting in this respect because she represents, as a 44-year-old, the maturity of the movement. We have to stop thinking about people like Jerry Falwell because there aren't that many Jerry Falwells around anymore. You're more likely to see a Sarah Palin, and she's not going to come across as mean-spirited or calling people out because she thinks they're demon-infested, even if she thinks that that's true, because she's politically smart and she knows how to sell herself. And that is the current threat of the religious right in America.
That was journalist and author Frederick Clarkson. Read his articles online at talktoaction.org. Clarkson's forthcoming book, Dispatches from the Religious Left, will be published in October. On August 23rd, two boats with 40 activists on board landed without incident at the port of Gaza, symbolically breaking for the first time the Israeli blockade over the Palestinian territory that is home to 1.5 million people. Israel closed Gaza to the outside world after the militant Palestinian group Hamas wrested control away from the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority. One of those on board was Bill Dienst, a physician from Washington State who had been to Gaza on four previous trips, beginning in 1985. He served as the ship's doctor. Once ashore in Gaza, some of the activists stayed on as Palestinians in need of medical care took their places on the boats and sailed back to Cyprus. When Dienst attempted to leave Gaza, he was prevented from doing so for several days by both the Israeli and Egyptian governments, making him an honorary Palestinian. He was eventually allowed to leave on September 7th and traveled back to the U.S. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dienst while he was still being detained inside Gaza. He talked about the goals of the Free Gaza movement, what life is like for Palestinians living there, and future plans for solidarity actions.
This is the first time boats have come in from sea to Gaza port in 41 years, since the 1967 war. We were greeted by approximately 100,000 people on the shores at Gaza Marina.
What happened when you tried to leave Gaza?
We escorted patients who have been denied medical care outside of Gaza to the Eretz checkpoint with Israel. The Israeli authorities threatened to shoot us. We continue to advance with our passports held in the air and our hands above our heads. They did not shoot, but we made it to the iron gate, but they would not open the gate, and they claimed they were then going to shut down the crossing, impairing the ability of other people to cross. So we had to retreat at that point. And fortunately, we had major media covering this. We had television, Al Jazeera, Ramatan television. And because of this, the Israelis did let this elderly woman pass to Jerusalem 2 days later. But what is sad is that you have to go through such extravagant media pressure for them to show any compassion. There's approximately 200 people who have died here due to lack of specialty medical care that's not available here. Then the following day, we tried to exit through Egypt. We spent 9 hours at the Egypt border to find out that we were denied because we entered by sea. And then the next day, we spent 13 hours, and we were denied entry also because we entered by sea. I'm getting the impression that the Egyptian authorities are under pressure by the Israelis and perhaps the American CIA to block our departure from Gaza in order to punish us for participating in the Free Gaza movement. We are now Palestinians, basically. We are trapped here. I am not a criminal. I'm a family and emergency room physician from Omak, Washington. I have no criminal record. I don't own any weapons of any sort. I'm of no risk to either the Israeli or the Egyptian people. Yet, because I participated in this nonviolent direct action, I am being barred from exiting Gaza.
Bill Dienst, what kind of impact do you think the Free Gaza movement has achieved with your symbolic breaking of the siege of Gaza coming in by boat?
Well, it certainly uplifted people's spirits. We had only two boats, and we could only carry a limited amount of supplies. We did have some medical anesthetic drugs that are needed for surgery. We have EKG machines that we're delivering to some small clinics here. We have toys, and we had various things for children. But, you know, it was just a drop in the bucket. That part is symbolic, but it is our intention to continue to come back and forth with boats. Another boat is slated to enter Gaza from Cyprus on around September 22nd. We also, there were 9 Palestinian nationals who left with the boats back to Cyprus and were successfully taken out of Gaza. One is a child who has a high-grade amputation after he had his leg blown off by an Israeli mortar shell, and he needs an orthotic or an artificial leg. Gaza should, like any other country, should have the right for people to come and go through its seaport. Major barges should be able to come and go without impedance from the Israeli military forces. I would also like to point out that some of the members of the Free Gaza movement who have stayed on, there's 10 of them, some have gone out with the fishermen on several occasions. Usually the fishermen get shot at about 6 nautical miles out. But the first attempt, they were able to get out to 12 nautical miles, and the fishermen caught more fish than they have caught in years. And then on a second attempt a few days ago, the fishermen were shot at, but because internationals were aboard, they didn't actually hit the ships. They just did warning shots. So there's that kind of harassment of people's ability to earn a livelihood, which goes on endlessly. And we're calling world attention to that that war crime as well.
Those of us paying attention have heard a lot about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. What can you tell us from your direct observation, especially as a physician? Did you see a lot of sick or malnourished people? Was the water supply adequate?
If you turn on the tap water now, it's very salty. I got amoebic dysentery again here. I'm being treated for that. Back in 85, the water was clean here. So the water is deteriorating. The healthcare infrastructure is deteriorating. We were at the Shifa Hospital, and basic supplies are lacking now because they're not being allowed in by Israel, or they're being allowed in very small, token significant amounts. They're turning the supply of basic essential things down, not to zero, but to less than what is adequate to take care of the population here. So it's a slow, painful, cruel control of people's essential resources to support their healthcare infrastructure, their education infrastructure, et cetera. It's something the world should pay attention to. Let's just put it that way. The world is ignoring it.
That was Dr. Bill Dienst of the Free Gaza Movement. Contact the group in the U.S. at area code 510-232-2500 or visit their website at freegaza.org. Responding to years of court decisions that have eroded whistleblower protections for federal employees, public interest activists and science advocacy groups are now pushing hard for the passage of new legislation that will effectively protect government worker whistleblowers from retaliation. In a recent survey of 3,400 government scientists at 9 federal agencies conducted by the Union of Concerned Scientists, nearly 1,100 said they fear retaliation for raising concerns about the work and mission of their agencies. Federal employees who have exposed waste, fraud, and abuse in the past have reported harassment, demotion, or termination. Documented cases can be found within the Army Corps of Engineers, the Food and Drug Administration, and Environmental Protection Agency. Additionally, the Bush administration in recent years has been accused of censorship and manipulation of scientific data in areas such as air pollution, climate change, and the control of toxic substances in pursuit of partisan political gain or to benefit corporate allies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Celia Wexler, Washington representative of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She discusses several examples of reprisals taken against whistleblowers and why her group believes that protection for federal employees are necessary to ensure the government is held accountable for safeguarding Americans' health, safety, and the environment.
This has essentially been an 8-year struggle to get really in federal law real protections for federal employees who blow the whistle on waste, fraud, and abuse in government, and for us at the Union of Concerned Scientists to make sure that that legislation also addresses situations where federal scientists report efforts to alter or suppress federal research. And here's the situation. Both last year, both the House and the Senate passed versions of whistleblower protection bills. For months, they haven't been able to get together, the House and Senate, on a final version of legislation. And in the Senate, there is a concern that if you strengthen the whistleblower law, then some Senate Republicans will follow the lead of the president, who doesn't like strengthening the whistleblower law at all, and try to block it. But our feeling is this, is that it's very important to hold the Congress accountable, and we want to vote. We want to vote in the Senate on a strong bill, as strong as possible. And we're willing, and when I talk about we, I'm talking about 182 organizations now that have signed on to endorsing strong whistleblower legislation, crossing the ideological spectrum here. We want, and we are willing to take a risk. It's better to get, to have the Congress try to pass a very strong whistleblower bill with access to jury trials for whistleblowers. So we need this strong bill, and we need the Senate really to take a chance and try to push forward a strong bill.
Give us some examples of recent instances where we've seen waste, fraud, and abuse, and federal employees have come forward to report on it to the public or to Congress that's overseeing these agencies, and they've gotten the shaft for it. Tell us what's happened.
In terms of scientists, my God, at the Food and Drug Administration, we have numerous examples of very distinguished scientists who have said that they had deep concerns about a series of different drugs. Dr. David Graham studied Vioxx and told the FDA that he thought that the drug Vioxx, the painkiller Vioxx, could be very dangerous in terms of potential heart attacks and heart problems. And basically, one of the folks at the FDA said, well, you know, you really, your studies and your contentions are based on a scientific rumor. And so the FDA didn't do anything for a good long while until the New England Journal of Medicine validated what Dr. Graham had said. And if the FDA had paid attention to Dr. Graham when it should have, if Dr. Graham had not been, you know, basically ignored and given short shrift, then perhaps 55,000 lives would have been saved. So repeatedly, in agency after agency, at the Fish and Wildlife Service, we had scientists who were told literally to you know, doctor their findings. They were told, for example, that instead of just assessing a policy at the Fish and Wildlife Service based on the economic costs and benefits, they should only consider the costs. So these are the things that scientists are dealing with day after day, and that's why we need a real and a strong whistleblower law enacted this year by Congress.
The corporate influence that we see in the Food and Drug Administration that you ran down to us, the sweetheart deals, no bid contracts going on with the Pentagon when it comes to defense contractors and such. How does this relate, you think, to this whole mindset that government's the enemy, but on the other hand, you have the crew in power basically doing all they can to discredit government?
Union of Concerned Scientists, it's a very nonpartisan, nonprofit. And I think it's also fair to say that we have definitely worked with members of Congress who are Republican and members of goodwill. I mean, there are people who have spoken up from either party for the rights of whistleblowers. But I think that said, overall in Washington, there is definitely strong pressure from corporate lobbyists on both parties to decrease the regulation that we need from government if we're going to keep ourselves healthy and safe. That influence, no matter who's in charge in the White House, those lobbyists are not going to go away, which is why, again, you need the legislation. We need whistleblowers, no matter which party dominates, because we're naive if we think that, you know, that corporate influence goes away if one party, the Republicans, are not in power. It doesn't.
That was Celia Wexler, Washington representative of the Scientific Integrity Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the union at area code 202-223-6133 or visit their website at ucsusa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.